Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
Thank you for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined today by a very special guest, Scott Hensley. Scott, this is probably the second, I would say, of what I'm hoping is going to be a flourishing off-season feature of having lacrosse conversations with people related to the sport, but not necessarily as directly as the coaches and players that we bring on all season long. So, you know, I wanted to talk with you for a variety of reasons that we will get into, but it all stems from the fact that you have a journalism background, and our ability to have a conversation about the idea of journalism, particularly lacrosse journalism, with someone who's a professional kind of within the industry, but without being a specialist in lacrosse, is really appealing to me. So as a specialist in the healthcare field with, currently working at NPR and experience at the Wall Street Journal, among other publications, can you just kind of explain, you know, your perspective and the career arc that has brought you to this very cramped Inside Lacrosse podcast studio?
Well, first, Terry, thanks a lot for having me. I'm a big fan of Inside Lacrosse and an avid consumer of the podcast. I've also learned a lot about social media from watching lacrosse Twitter and what you guys do, and also some of the other folks. I've actually gotten some things out of that that I use in my day job, where I'm an editor at NPR on the science desk and work mostly in health. These days, I'm working on global health and development stories, so what's happening in Mexico, Africa, places like that. And lacrosse is, you know, what I do for fun, and it's kind of my break, both mentally when I'm on the job, looking at my Twitter stream, sort of balancing the health policy serious tweets with, you know, what Dan Abern or Kyle have got cooking. And, it really, people hear me laughing, and they're like, oh, what happened now? And they're kind of hip to the fact that, you know, I'm interspersing the work stuff with the lacrosse Twitter as it happens.
And it does stem from being a Johns Hopkins undergrad and being introduced to the game there, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I grew up in Connecticut, and the high school I went to, a public high school, didn't have lacrosse. I kind of heard of it, I guess. You know, prep schools in the area played it, but I didn't know anything about it. And then I showed up at Johns Hopkins, and, you know, it was almost a religion. And at that time, it was the early 80s when I was at Hopkins. The team was just a juggernaut. And it was also one of the fun things. I would say, like, spring fair and lacrosse were the fun things. And the rest of the year, you know, it was really, it was a grind. You know, I enjoyed it. I got a great education, and I ultimately ended up liking it. But I remember the first lacrosse game that I went to was in the spring of 1980. And Hopkins just dismantled Yale. And I went with my roommate, who was from Evanston, Illinois, and like me, had never seen a lacrosse game, but it was free, and our dorm was almost a stone's throw from Homewood Field. So we just went over there, and we just thought, hey, this is really fun. It was, just a good time, and that's really how I got started on it. I've never played it, except, I should qualify that. Back then, I think, I don't know if they still do it, but there was this sort of Hopkins indoctrination where, they would put together intramural teams from the different dorms. And the freshman dorms, only the freshmen were guaranteed dorm housing. So you would play the dorm next to you. And the main rule was that if you actually played on the team, you couldn't be on the intramural team, obviously. And that meant that I think nobody in our dorm had any experience playing lacrosse at all. So we would go they would drop off like a bag of old equipment, and we'd try and figure out what to do with it. And it was just a pretty hilarious slapstick experience, since most of us had never held a stick before. And there was always, it seemed like the other dorms had a couple of guys who at least knew how to play. And I remember we went into one game, and these two guys who were from Baltimore were just killing us. And it was even beyond embarrassing. So there was one guy who was a swimmer on our team, and we said, just hit that guy. And there were refs, and so that guy got taken out, and then the ref was just like, don't do that again! And we laughed, and it became a cause for celebration. We go off and have gin and tonics afterward, and after the season wore on, we decided, let's have the gin and tonics ahead of time. It won't hurt our game any. So really, that was my limited playing experience, both under the influence and not.
Well, we can take heart in knowing that, you know, the more things change, they stay the same. Lacrosse remains your diversion as your, you know, kind of tried and true kind of health focused career born out of your undergraduate education at Hopkins. So, you know, a very helpful and informed experience. One of the other things I'm really excited about talking to you about is just what it's like to consume lacrosse, you know, kind of in this modern way. And so we'll talk about that. But first, just want to set the table for why we're having this conversation,
right?
Because I do think it helps to inform a lot of the comments that are yet to come, which is, you know, probably 3 weeks ago, I was, you know, sitting in this very studio talking with Quint about some of the forthcoming stories. And I explained how difficult I found the balance of practicing journalism in this role to be. And I think I stated it pretty poorly. And if I were going to try to state it again, I would say that, you know, Inside Lacrosse is an entity in my mind. We're not a traditional journalistic outfit in the to the same degree that a daily newspaper is.
Right.
I like to use the term, kind of a euphemism, we're a media company. And I do think that, you know, that it's represented in our content in a lot of different ways. If we were, you know, a pure journalistic outfit, we probably wouldn't do the gear coverage that we do. The
right.
type of thing that has cross sections with the commercial aspects of our business and everything else that goes along with it. And I think that that lives in one side of my brain, and the other side says there are certain types of stories that we pursue and try to kind of utilize journalistic principles to the degree that we know and understand them. And so, you know, just you could call it breaking news or something like that. I like the term unconfirmed or unconfirmable news, right? Because it's not necessarily breaking. Like sometimes announcements are breaking, and it's
right.
also not investigative, because to me, investigative should be reserved for something that happens over a long period of time and utilizes a lot of different inroads to understand the story. This is simply, you know, the types of things like coaching moves or new program development or whatever the case may be. But, you know, high interest stories that for a period of time go from being reported to officially announced. And
right.
during that period of time, what happens? And leading up to that period of time, what happens? And so in those instances, you know, I'd like to think that we ascribe to what we all either have been taught or learned by doing, which, you know, includes things like giving the subjects an opportunity to comment or, you know, confirm or disconfirm, and, you know, the different type of source development that leads to being accurate, right? And understanding that accuracy above all else is the standard. And so, you know, that kind of brings us to the point where talking about some of these stories in particularly, whether it be, you know, the reporting around the establishment of the Utah varsity lacrosse program and everything else, you know, we'll dive into the specifics a little bit later on. But it's funny because there's been a lot of activity in this conversation over the course of the last week, which is
right.
after we agreed that we were going to have this
yeah.
conversation. And so, you know, a lot of specifics that we can dive into. But just before we even start, wanted to get your reaction to that. I mean, what is your take on what is your opinion of my characterization of Inside Lacrosse and where we fall on this spectrum of a traditional journalistic entity or enterprise, you know, through kind of up until this, you know, definition of a modern media company?
I think a media company sounds about right. And I would say that even the so-called traditional journalistic organizations find themselves changing. You know, there's the events businesses, your gear comment, I would say there are lots of publications that include restaurant reviews or reviews of a play or maybe, you know, travel recommendations. So I think there's different types of journalism and service journalism. You know, I think, you know, the way that we got started on this conversation was on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
Let's be clear. I'm at Scott Hensley on Twitter. And I'd listen to the podcast, and the thing that struck me as a listener was the notion that you knew stuff that you weren't telling the audience.
Yep.
And I said, hey, look, you know, your duty as a journalist, I mean, I didn't say all this in a tweet because it was too long, but, you know, we went at it a little bit, was, you know, your duty is first to the audience. And if you know something and you're sure you know it, then you should report it. And I'm sympathetic, though, on these developing stories that you may know something that doesn't hold, like it changes. And so I think how do you characterize what you know, and how do you decide when you should sort of tell the world, or do you let it ripen, or do you say, you know, I'm not really confident enough to go out with this right now? And so I think that was the context for it. My feeling, and which was longer than a tweet, was there's lots of stories that develop where you don't know everything you want to know, but you know enough. And so you can report, if you choose, we've learned that so-and-so is a leading candidate, or we've learned that the top three people who have now interviewed at, in this case, University of Michigan, but it could be any place given all the coaching changes that seem to be happening around this time of year, it would be possible to sort of lay that out there and say, you know, this is a fluid situation. It's no guarantee that this person who's talking now is going to be the one who gets the job, but this is the short list. And you guys have done that in the past. So I want to be fair. You know, we've, you know, the Twitter is a sort of reactive medium, and it was just sort of in one of those moments where I was listening to the podcast. I think it was on the Metro going to work, and I fired one off from my phone as I was listening
to that. You got service on the Metro?
Yeah. Well, luckily, where I am in D.C., which is where I live, I was above the
– Got it.
I was above ground. So that part of my trip I can do and, you know, download the latest podcast or tweet as the case may be. So I don't know. Does that help at all?
It does. And I think that, you know, there are a couple of different considerations, even within that idea of when you know something, you should share it, and your responsibility is to the audience. And I think one of the interesting questions is, you know, in sports, there's probably a lower threshold for the degree to which you do have responsibility to the audience than in other beats, like, for example, crime or government or health or whatever else the case may be.
Really?
I do think that.
Why do you?
Because the... It doesn't, because the knowledge doesn't serve the audience's interest in the way that they live their lives to the degree that it does in other realms.
But they're passionate about it. That's why they come to you.
I'm not saying that they don't deserve to know to some degree. I'm right. just saying that the threshold is lower.
You know, I'm not sure I agree. Okay. I think it's not life or death, that's for sure.
Yeah.
It's not a life or death thing, but, you know, do I care less about, you know, what's happened with Dave Petromala? Versus, you know, some of the things that I do in my day job, like health policy, maybe a little bit, but it's different parts of my brain.
Sure.
I think emotionally, I don't care any less. You know, it's like I'm a fan. I'm here representing a fan first and then sort of with this journalistic overlay. And that's part of what was contributing to my tweet, which is I really want to know this.
Yeah.
Now, it's not going to change my life for sure, but it's something that you know, whatever your passion is, you know, you do care about that. And so I think that's part of why, in fact, Inside Lacrosse is successful, is that you there's a part of you guys that you guys bring that. You know, you sort of, you know, the passion around this game and what people care about, and you try to give it to them. And so the question is, how do you sort of balance that? How do you decide when to do it? You have got production issues. I mean, even if you have a zillion stories, you can't do them all at the same time.
Right.
So I think I'm not willing to give you a pass on that.
Okay, that's helpful perspective. I mean, that's why we're having this conversation.
Yeah.
The second point I would like to make is, or get your reaction to, is if so this is a competitive world. These beats are, you know, being the person who reports it does have value in some capacity. If I were to argue that reporting the candidate pool injures my ability to report who gets the job first, essentially
sure.
gives my competition an advantage that if I didn't report that, I wouldn't be giving them, is that a justifiable reason to withhold the candidate pool?
Yes.
Okay.
Because that you're, you know, that's something that as a consumer or as a reader or a listener, I can't know that. But as a journalist, you have to make choices about, okay, you know, how does doing the story now affect my ability to advance the story later on? Now, the flip side of the competition is, as we saw with the University of Michigan job, the other people aren't, you know,
they're not sitting
on their hands.
Yeah.
They're out there working sources. They're trying to figure it out. And so that's the other part, which is, okay, at what point do I go out with something, and when do I get the sort of incremental advantage for my publication? You know, I think you guys are the flagship publication in lacrosse, so people look to you guys for, you know, the definitive word. I mean, U.S. Lacrosse has the magazine, and they do a good job, but they do different stuff. You know, it's really, I look at that as, you know, the house organ of the foundation, and people who are trying to, you know, encourage the game, support the game. You guys wear multiple hats. They wear multiple hats. They're sort of the official sort of house organ for lacrosse in the country. You guys are the scrappy competitor who came up and have newsy stuff and, you know, are edgier and also are, I think, much more working on time-sensitive stuff. Like, mm-hmm. you guys have competitive spirits. Like, you want to get those stories out there, whether it's on social media, you're doing things with podcasts, and mm-hmm. also what you do with a website. So I think the standard for you guys is high. Like, you know, as the news breakers and the people who we look to for news, we come to you first.
Sure.
Now the equation definitely changes, and we've seen that in the last year as, you know, the College Cross guys and Ryan Dennehy have stepped up and, you know, done their own reporting and have their own outlets, whether it's Twitter or, right. you know, the
their website.
Yeah, their website, exactly.
So the last thing I would ask you is, what is the threshold by which your reporting is allowed to be the story or is allowed to impact the story? Like, and
how do you mean?
There's one very specific example, but then there's also middle grounds of this that didn't come to fruition. But so when we look at the situation surrounding Don Charger's contract status,
right,
at the end of last season, we reported that he was not going to be offered a contract extension.
Right.
Felt very firm on that and felt very firm on the sourcing. I would contend that in reaction to our report, the pressure on the Virginia Athletic Administration increased to the degree that he ended up receiving a contract extension.
Right.
So my argument is that the report changed the reality. The report became part of the story. Had that not been reported when it was, I don't think he ever would have gotten a contract extension because I don't think the pressure would have increased. So what does that do when a story can in and of itself make itself false, so to speak? I mean, that...
False, I don't think I would do that. I mean, that's, you know, you were talking before about, or a little bit about investigative reporting. In a sense, I would say you did investigative reporting there. You found out something that was not known to the public or even at that point to the... to the alumni base, mm-hmm. and then when it became known, there was a reaction, which is, well, wait a second, what are you doing here? That's the same thing as, you know, when you report about some behind-the-scenes deal in business or up on Capitol Hill, and it gets out there, and then shareholders or constituents say, well, wait a second, we don't want that, or, you know, we're gonna make some noise about that, and then it changes the decision of the company or it changes what happens on a vote or changes the way that policy goes down. I mean, I think
that is not a consideration in your mind then.
No, I think it's a good thing. Yeah. You should want that.
Yeah.
You know, it's like if you get a story and it's accurate and you get it out there, and then that leads to other things happening that wouldn't have happened without that knowledge. That's what journalism is all about. You want to take the things that people in power don't want the world to know,
yeah,
and bring it to the world and say, hey, check this out. This is what's happening right now. And you don't have to pass judgment on it. I mean, you have latitude given the nature of what it is, but I mean, you're basically presenting the facts saying, hey, look, you know, we've learned this. And you're confident that it's true, and then you report what happens next, which you guys did.
Yeah, and it becomes problematic because typically those safeguards that are put in place to keep that information contained become stronger, and it becomes even more difficult than to get the story right. And
that's
you know, but oftentimes you get a counterbalance of those who with whom you've curried favor because of the reaction that was generated, where it's like, all right, you might be able to get some new source material.
Absolutely.
On the basis of those who understand the power that the platform holds.
Look, the people in power are going to respect you more for when you get a scoop and you know, whether they admit it or not. That shows them that you have power.
Right.
And it also shows the audience and the people, you know, in this small world of lacrosse or whatever it is, every beat, you know, has this, you know, where there's people in power who want things known and other things they don't want known. And as a journalist, it's your job to try and ferret that out and then communicate it when you think it's ripe and sort of relevant. And then when you do that, the people in power, you know, they take countermeasures. Hey, don't let them do that again if they try and figure out how you got it. And then other people say, hey, these guys know what they're doing. They were fair. They were accurate. that leads to respect from sources who then say, oh, look, I can talk to this person.
Right. So there's aspects of source management that we may not have time to get into. You mentioned something that I want to revisit, and it's the idea of, you know, competition that has different types of distribution platforms and whatever else. And so, you know, what I want to ask about is your opinion of the way in which standards can float. One of the things that caught my attention last summer was Ryan Danahy, who, you know, has been an assistant coach, you know, first at Dartmouth, then at Michigan, now a volunteer assistant at Penn and with the New York Lizards, was tweeting a lot of information about how these things were happening. And it was an emerging kind of disruptive force in the market, which I think he has said both privately to me and publicly to many other people was the goal.
Yeah.
That being said, he did tweet one thing that I had a hard time reconciling at one point. In the context of reporting that Kevin Corrigan was going to become Virginia's coach, he tweeted, "The worst thing we can be is wrong, right?" And the way that I interpreted that, and I'll concede that there's room for interpretation in here, is that being wrong isn't that big of a deal. And that might be too much of a stretch, but the problem was, I'm not going to allow that to be a standard with which I'm willing to compete.
Right.
So what's your opinion on that? Like or if you were in my position, how do you think you would approach that in terms of, like, do you just kind of seed the ground and say, like, yeah, I mean, if you're willing to take a risk on a report that may or may not be right to the degree that I am not, then you're probably going to beat me every single time because the effort to be certain takes longer. So it's a very general question about speed versus accuracy. And, you know,
it's also brand. It's also your brand.
Sure.
I mean, he doesn't have the brand risk that you have. You're inside lacrosse. You've got to stand behind those stories in a different way. Nothing against Ryan and what the guys at Lax All-Stars are doing. They're cool and, you know, they're having a good time. You know, if you have questions about how much of a journalist or not you are in the traditional sense, I think they have even more questions, you know. But let's be honest. This is a craft, not a science. This is not, you know, we don't license people in this country to become journalists, and I'm glad of that. People
Sure.
should not have to, you know, pass a special test or show that they, you know, have gone to a school, you know, for journalism in order to write stories and report them. But if you're trying to build an audience, people pay attention to your batting average, and it's definitely up to that person how much they want to risk. You know, am I really right about this? I think it's possible as a journalist to say, and this is hard in one tweet, but to put the caveats on it. So when I was a business reporter, sometimes the set of stories that's a lot like journalism is mergers and acquisition. And like sports, it's mergers and acquisition. And, you know, it's like, is this, you know, are these two companies, is this company going to buy that company? You know, are these deals going to happen? And, you know, you would, you know, especially when you're at the Wall Street Journal, you know, it's like the incremental news on whether something might happen could be enough that you would report it and you would source it well and you would check it out. But, you know, often, and you see this, you know, all the time, even now, is like people would put in there, you know, according to sources familiar with the situation, and the deal is in an early stage, and there's no guarantee that it will happen. It could fall apart, da 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 da. And so I think some of these coaching moves, let's face it, they're business stories in a way.
Right.
It's like, you know, who's going to be the CEO of this D1 lacrosse program? You know, that's the kind of thing that, you know, you could substitute some words and it would be like, who's going to be the CEO of this company? And if people care about that industry, like, say, who's going to succeed, you know, Travis Kalanick at Uber, you know, not that different from D1, you know, in the sense of people want to know who's going to be the person to lead that company. How are they going to change the culture? What's that company going to do? So when it comes to something back to Ryan and his speculation about whether Corrigan, or it was more than speculation, he was saying it was a done deal, right? Well, look bad on him. Now, you could have said, and I think your reporting was more nuanced, looking at, well, Corrigan was a strong candidate. Looked like he might get it. But then you tell me what happened.
Well, I mean, all we reported was that he had informed the alums that he wasn't going to take it.
Right.
So, you know, whether he was offered and declined the offer, or whether or not he was never offered, or you know, withdrew before an offer, an imminent offer was to come,
uh-huh.
or utilized it as a renegotiation position with Notre Dame, you know, those are details that we never reported. We only reported and then quickly moved on to.
Did you know?
I didn't, and I still don't, and I honestly am not that certain as to how serious a candidate actually ever was.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, that was one where on paper it looked logical.
For sure.
Yeah. So, you know, I can see where it would make sense, and maybe those guys talk to people, and, you know, Towers and Ryan know a ton of people. Who knows? Who knows what people told them? But I think, you know, this cycle is predictable every year. There's coaching changes. There's speculation about, okay, these are the hot jobs. Who's going to get them? There's the sort of domino effect.
Who are the logical candidates?
Who's the logical candidates? If this guy moves, then what happens? And then there's the classic thing, which is which coaches are going to go down the road enough to use it as leverage so they get a better deal. Because they don't really want to go, but they want to get a longer contract. They want to get better terms on their contract. They have something else that they want for the program. And they can go to the AD or whoever it is and say, look, you know, it's a nice looking job over here. You know, there's ways to, you know. So these are predictable things. So then the question is, which of those things is newsworthy? You know, and, you know, when it comes to UVA, you know, within the little lacrosse world, people are very interested in it.
Right.
It's a marquee program, one of the best. And likewise, this season, University of Michigan, it's like, you know, coming on strong, huge resources, you know, sleeping giant, ready to go. So that, you know, to me, the twists and turns on a program like that, the news value is potentially higher. So as a journalist, I'm not covering it. That's what you guys are doing. But if I'm using the same kind of calculation that I would in beats that I do cover, I'd be inclined to go with the incremental news and to go with the stuff, making sure that it's, you know, ripe enough, and then putting the caveats in there that say it's early stages of the conversation, things could change, there are other candidates, da 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 da. That's the way that I would kind of approach it and think about it. And then at the other end, like, think about some of the other changes last year, like Binghamton. You know, it's like, hey, that's interesting, and you look this past season at how Binghamton did, you know, such a turnaround. In hindsight, maybe it would have been more of a story to cover. Not that you guys didn't cover,
right.
You did, but I'm just thinking in the calculation, I care less about Binghamton, no offense to them,
right.
than I do about UVA. So I wouldn't put the same resources or think about it as much. It's like, if we get the story and we find out about it, we'll put it out there because we want to have complete coverage. But there's a few of these sexy jobs and really important jobs where it's like people really want to know.
How important do you think the postmortem coverage is? So, for example, you know, you come to learn that this, and this happened after the situation has resolved itself. And I'll put it this way. So Marquette announces that they've extended Joe Amplo.
Right.
How interested are you in knowing to what degree the negotiations with Michigan advanced with Joe Amplo?
A little.
Yeah.
A little.
Yeah.
What about you?
I mean, I think that people would be interested to learn the extent to which the conversation developed with Sean Adelin after Joe Amplo turned that down. And I think that that was one of the complicating factors as it related to the Kevin Connery story. And we saw, and I think that this is an important part of the distinction of the way in which we tried to write our story relative to both College Cross's report as well as Ed Lee's report. So there were two things that were concurrent. The first is Ed reported on a week ago. Well, so at this point it'll be, you know, mid-June. I think it was like June 11th or so, Monday, that he reported an interview that he had conducted with Sean the previous week in which Sean said he was happy at Towson and wasn't intended to leave.
Right.
That day, we knew that Sean was in Ann Arbor. So that is an important piece of the calculus.
Right, but that's a classic misdirection play. He doesn't want to let people know.
Right. So, well, but also when he said it, he may not have known. It wasn't, Joe Amplo had not turned the job down, you know? So maybe his trip was not scheduled at that point.
Yeah.
Kevin Connery interviewed or visited 2 days later, the Wednesday.
Yeah.
For the subsequent 6 days, Sean had ongoing conversations with Michigan. It comes to pass that the Tuesday morning that College Cross reported that Kevin Connery was going to take over,
Chris Chisholm, Yastrzemski.
Yes, Chris. Sorry. When Chris Yastrzemski reported that he was going to take over.
Sorry on the last name, Chris. I tried.
The conventional wisdom that I was privy to was that Sean had not yet turned the job down and had not been offered to Kevin. The equal part of the conventional wisdom was that if Sean did turn the job down, Kevin was going to be offered and accepted. So, you know, that was kind of the stance of preparation that we were aware of. And then the report comes out, you know, we were able to connect with Sean to learn that he had in fact turned it down. Ed reported that Kevin had not heard from them. There was actually, and this is little known, and we didn't include this in our report.
Get it out there now.
When Kevin was was offered the job on Tuesday, he turned it down. He reconnected with them on Wednesday morning and accepted at that point. So it was.
He thought it over. Or he had reconsidered.
I have a feeling Michigan thought it over. Or reconsidered.
Got it.
and then accepted. And now, you know, at that point, we posted our story that he had accepted the offer and that it was going to be announced on Wednesday. You know, and there was some consternation over the phrasing that we utilized. And I think that one of the points that I want to clarify, because didn't really want to engage on social media because I felt like it wasn't going to be able to be. Like, my point wasn't going to be able to be clear enough, clearly enough communicated that I was going to feel comfortable with it. The reason we stated it the way that we did is because to have simply said Chris's report, first report, that Kevin was going to get the job would have been to discredit Ed's report. However, we, our knowledge, our source, verified Ed's report. And so I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to make it seem like one was wrong or the other was wrong. They were both, in fact, right. One was
at their moment in time.
What? Yeah, one was at a forthcoming moment.
Yeah,
you know. So it was pretty clear that Chris's report was going to become right, but at the time, and the way that he phrased it was also accurate. Kevin was going to become the next coach at Michigan,
right?
But he had not been offered and he had not accepted. So, you know, that was part of what we wanted to make clear that when Ed had spoken to his sources, they were telling him a story that was in line with what we had heard. This is all by way of saying that this is not a simple process or a simple task. And so that's where, you know, a conversation with someone like you who has a really well-developed perspective on something that, you know, we can dispute, but, you know, I think is an even more high-stakes world of journalism is really fascinating to me. Yeah. And so that's why I wanted to, you know, continue to get your opinion.
Nobody wants the scoop that never gets duplicated because it's wrong. That's that you want to avoid. So back to the, you know, Corrigan example. You know, this is a case where if you look at sort of a timeline of the stories, at the moments that they were published, you know, they were right. And it's a fluid news situation. And so, you know, it's a question of, you know, when do you pull the trigger? You know, how confident are you in what you're stating? And then I think this one was actually, you know, well played in the sense that, you know, Chris was the, you know, had the first sort of definitive story, and then people quickly followed Ed, you guys, and also gave credit.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's an honorable way to approach this in the news business. I mean, it's competitive, and I think it's healthy for journalism. There's too many areas of journalism as it shrinks where there's not enough competition. It's great to see, you know, that we now got on this key story for this season. A lot of people going after it and getting interesting stories, and you know, eventually it all comes out and it works out. And I think it's good.
So that's the last place I want to leave, which is, you know, after this all settled down, a coach sent me a text that was joking but had its nugget of truth, which was lacrosse Twitter: colon, you're right. No, I'm right. No, you're so smart. No, I'm so smart. No, you're so smart. Oh yeah, and a coach got a new job. And so the question is, like, how sensitive do we need to be at the idea that we are not the story? Like, the conduit of the story is not the story. And then how does that parlay itself with credit? What's your overall opinion on, you know, the balance of those who report the story need to remove themselves from the story?
I'm not that dogmatic about it. I mean, there's different media and different ways that the stories are presented. So in the way that it was written up, you know, for your site, you know, it was a pretty straight ahead news story. Here are the facts. Here's what we know. Da 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 da. Attributions and including the credit to Chris. Ed Lee follows the newspaper traditions of the Baltimore Sun, and Chris and the gang. They're pretty talented in their own right. They're a little cheekier and a little edgier, but I think in the reporting on this, I think Chris was using standard journalistic practices and was trying to tell people what he knew. Now, Twitter is something else. It's like, don't hold Twitter to the exact same standards that you do the magazine or the sort of website of record, if that is such a thing.
Mm-hmm.
Twitter is real time. Twitter is chatter. Twitter is messaging back and forth.
It's also really brief.
It's really brief. It's
designed
right?
to be very brief.
Yeah, it's designed to be very brief. So, I think if you're holding yourself to journalistic standards and you're doing something that's, you want the tweets to hold up. There are certain things that like for me, lacrosse is fun. I'm not being a journalist when I'm tweeting about lacrosse. I'm just a fan. But if I'm tweeting about healthcare, which is my day job, or if I'm tweeting about things related to where I work, I'm going to be accurate, going to be clear. I might have a sense of humor or a take, but I'm going to be grounded in the facts, and I'm going to make sure that, I'm sort of holding myself to the extent I can in 140 characters and an image and a link to sort of the traditional standards of fairness and accuracy in what I do there. I don't think – let's back up here for a second. Lacrosse and the extent to which we care about it is fun.
Mm-hmm.
It's our entertainment. And so – we want to be fair to people because, on the other hand, it's also a business. So these are coaches' livelihoods. Yep. you don't want to be cavalier about that because, what happens, with these jobs can change literally their lives. So, there is a seriousness to it, level.
And to a degree further, as it relates to the reporting about these jobs, an inaccurate report can impact whether or not a recruit comes to campus or whether
not
a commitment is upheld or a kid transfers out, which can impact whether or not they win games, which can impact whether or not they're employed for, the next time around. You know what I mean? So, it's a chain reaction that has serious considerations.
But here's another, example where you also, as a journalist, want to get the information out there so that future recruits might want to know, hey, this particular coach is like – raising his hand for every job that comes along.
Right.
It's like if you read that Coach X has been on the short list for, three different jobs in three different years, and he was ready to go, but it didn't work out because somebody else did it, then maybe as a recruit you're thinking, is that guy going to really stick around?
Right. You're right.
I want to know that. And I think you got to find the best stories you can get and, get them out there. And when it comes to Twitter, look, Twitter is Twitter. You're just like, come on.
So, it's not lost on me the irony that, you can make comments about whether or not what we're doing is, super self-gratifying. And then you, after having spoken about the idea of doing it for 30 minutes, but, I do want to get your perspective on what it's like to be a lacrosse fan in 2017, because, it's important, I think, for other lacrosse fans to hear the perspective of like a person like you. You're, obviously a big fan. You're a well dialed in follower of the sport. How do you characterize what it's like to be a lacrosse fan right now?
Well, I am. I don't think I'm representative. Let me just stipulate that. So, for one thing, maybe I am. I'm a cord cutter, so I don't watch ESPN at home. If I'm going to go to a game, I go usually in person. So I have the advantage that I live in DC suburbs. And so it's, 15 minutes to College Park for me. I bop over to Baltimore and see the Blue Jays. I'm a Hopkins fan, as you mentioned in the intro. And, but I'll go to other games. I've gone up to Loyola. I love Ridley. It's a great place to see a game. I love going to Annapolis and, Navy Marine Corps Stadium is just, I think, one of the great places. I've got relatives in Charlottesville, so I head down to UVA every time I get a chance, and we'll take in a game there. So I tend to go in person, And when I can't do that, I'm the guy who's like trying to convince the bartender, can you turn that TV over there to ESPNU so I can watch this game? And I've got a friend who went to Notre Dame who I've now turned on to lacrosse. He didn't know anything about lacrosse, but he loves everything Notre Dame. So, you know, we can go out, we can go over to his house and hang out and watch it. So he hasn't cut the cord yet. So my consumption is mainly in person. And, you know, when I can't make the game or if it's an away game, you know, I'll go watch a bar somewhere. And I highly recommend that, actually. And people are more willing. Even in – I was in Florida on a business trip found this divey bar in Orlando off the beaten path. And the bartender turned one of the TVs in the side room onto the Hopkins game. And these old guys who were day drinking were coming over and saying, what is that you're watching? So maybe I converted a few of them.
They didn't think it was highlight?
They didn't think it was
that. That can happen every once in a while in Florida.
Yeah. And the other thing is I have a kid who plays. So I have two sons, and one of them is plays U13 rec league. And so I go to a lot of his games and, you know, tournaments and stuff like that. So that's a whole other aspect of the game. So we'll see.
And then you use the social media access as kind of like a shoulder conversation to provide context in between watching the games.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's like, you know, I'm like a lot of people, you know, I'm a two screen watcher. So if I'm watching the game, I've got the Twitter feed open, and I love, you know, like I've gone to Bayhawks game, getting ready to go probably again this summer before the season's over. And I really love the stream on Twitter with the game of the week. I think that's great. I haven't bit the bullet and subscribed to Lax Sports Network, but I might. I mean, maybe next year. We'll see. So, you know, I'm trying to piece it together, and it's part of the reason I like the podcast. I mean, one of the things that frustrates me is that even around here, which is a legit lacrosse hotbed, you know, you got Ed Lee, and, you know, I love what he does. But there should be, you know, like the Washington Post, which I read every day, has minimal lacrosse coverage. And, you know, this year they covered, you know, a little bit as the season went on, and then the championship weekends with the women and the men's team. And, you know, then they had some nice coverage. But, you know, I don't understand the Washington Post's decision not to devote more resources to that sport, considering the number of Division I teams within the area of subscribers and the growth in interest. You know, there's more, like they cover it better as a prep sport, you know, with the different high schools than they do with what's happening at Navy, Georgetown, Maryland, even sneaking over towards Baltimore a little bit. I mean, if you think of the people who are going to, you know, or UVA or UMBC, Towson.
Richmond.
Yeah, Richmond. I mean, it's just like, I don't get it.
Yeah.
So for me, long-winded answer to your question, you know, I'm trying to piece together my own news service, which is how I think of Twitter. I mean, I am in there partaking of it. But really, for me, Twitter is like a wire service. By figuring out who you follow, you can put together your feed, and that's the headline. So I'm getting scores, I'm getting takes, I'm having fun talking with people about what's happening with the games or the sport. And to me, that fills the void that a lot of the conventional, you know, media are not filling.
Right. And I think that's ultimately been kind of the lifeblood of what we've tried to do at Inside Lacrosse, right?
Absolutely.
Like, you know, just find those gaps and paint them in a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, in the theme of enjoying the conversation, I've enjoyed this one.
All right.
It's been awesome.
Me too. Yeah. And, you know, I want to say thank you for having me. I also want to say to Mark Dixon, I could have done this by phone. But given the grief that I gave you about phoner tape and my support for Dan Flynn doing it live in person, I wanted to do the same. So here I am in the little podcast studio at IL World headquarters, and it was totally worth it. And I've also, Terry outfitted me with a red Solo cup, so I feel complete.
Fantastic. Land on the gauntlet, man of your word. Totally appreciate it. Scott, this has been awesome, and we look forward to continuing the conversation on Twitter. It's the only place to have it.
Absolutely. Thanks, Terry.
Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.